Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Big old show planned for you today. Two guests are going to be joining me in just a little bit. Shortly, we're going to be talking about the Democratic primary and this concept of electability. Well, I've looked at some of the polls, and I would like to put out my own idea of what is electable in 2020. I do want to say, though, if you're joining us for this live video right now, you may not know that before our show, usually like 20, 30, 40 minutes before the show, on our YouTube channel, we do daily live videos. So you can go to youtube.com/thedamagereport and subscribe, hit the bell, all that stuff, so you can see that every day. We had a great little discussion going on with thousands of viewers that crashed, unfortunately, because of some technical error. But anyway, it is a lot of fun. So if you haven't been joining us for those, you should definitely do it. We do it every day before the show. It's a lot of fun. So much to get to. Why don't we jump right into it? We hear a lot in this Democratic primary about electability, how important it is. And what's interesting is that it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that all the voters are saying, I want a candidate who can win. I think this candidate can win, and I'm gonna support it. Well, why do you support that candidate? Well, they have a lot of supporters. That seems to mean that they can win. So it's a sort of circular thing. But I've been looking at the polls, and I think there's actually a couple different directions we could go in. So I wanna inject a little bit of new data into this consideration. Before we do this, though, I do wanna show you a little bit of a video from earlier on today, I believe. It was Steve Kornacki talking about some of these new general election polls and revealing something that I think Democratic primary voters really need to know. So let's watch.
Heading into the critical Iowa caucuses, we have a look at some new polls. In the last 24 hours, a bunch of new polls come out here. A national poll from Monmouth yesterday, they find something we've been seeing for a while now. Biden clearly in the lead in this poll. Sanders clearly in second. Warren in third, clearly behind him. By the way, Bloomberg, with all that money spent outside the first four states, getting to 9% here. But check this out. The other national poll to come out yesterday from CNN, first time you've seen that in a long time. Yeah. Bernie Sanders in the lead nationally. What's the difference between what you found in the CNN poll that has Sanders ahead? Non-white voters. In this poll, this CNN poll, he leads Biden. Whoa, he leads Biden by 3 points among non-white voters. I don't know which of those polls is right, but if Sanders is going to win the nomination, that's where he's got to build support. You see in that poll what happens when he does.
Yeah, there does seem to be something happening in the national polls, and the trend lines in Iowa appear to be converging as well, if you believe some of the private numbers we've looked at.
So Chuck Todd acknowledging there does seem to be something happening. We'll see if he continues to acknowledge that going forward. But what Steve Kornacki said there was good. Now look, if you look at all the polls, they don't all tell the exact same story. That first poll they were showing has Joe Biden continuing to have an ever narrowing, but a lead over Bernie Sanders nationally. But that second poll got talked about a lot yesterday. It was a CNN poll. He's gained 7 points since the last CNN poll, which is back in December. That is significant. This is not just some fly by night operation, which did like one poll. No, this is like a gold standard pollster. They use both landlines and cell phones. They do call cell phones and they conduct live interviews. It's not an automated thing that can skew the results itself. This is a very reliable poll, and they're acknowledging that things are changing. Also credit to them for acknowledging what the mainstream media very rarely wants to acknowledge, which is that the concept of the Bernie bro doesn't make any sense when you look at the people who are actually voting for him. He has gotten this lead in large part because he's doing better and better amongst non-white voters. We're gonna have some more numbers for you on that in just a little second. Actually, why don't we turn to that right now? About 40% of Democratic primary voters are non-white, and somewhere around 20% are black. It's a disproportionate share of the Democratic primary vote. So it's very important. Now, most challengers to Biden have lacked support in this group. Sanders, though, is more than holding his own. He's at 30% with non-white voters compared to 24% among white voters. So he's a significant boost in popularity in non-white voters over his white support. That seems like the sort of thing that should drive a narrative in the mainstream media, but you don't see it. They still talk as if the only people that support Bernie Sanders are white frat boys. It's just not what we're seeing when we look at the actual polls. When we go to, here's a Morning Consult poll from earlier this month. This is Hispanic voters. Bernie Sanders has 33% of that group. The second place candidate, Joe Biden, has 23. So you see that Bernie Sanders there has a full 1/3 of all the Hispanic vote in this Democratic primary, which is important because a Univision analysis showed that Latino turnout doubled in the 2018 midterms in 8 states, Nevada, California, Texas, Florida, and New York. Now, to some extent, that could be important in a general election, but it's really important in a primary election where you have more and more political engagement and activity amongst Latino Americans, and they seem to be siding more and more with Bernie Sanders. In part because they tend to be on the younger side, they tend to be on the more progressive side, and so obviously they have an affinity with Bernie Sanders there, but important that we actually acknowledge it. Now, in terms of electability, we care about the primary, but really we're talking about the general election. It's us trying to figure out who is going to do the best against Donald Trump, assuming he's the nominee, which he almost certainly is going to be. Well, amongst important groups, it seems like Bernie Sanders is probably doing pretty well there. If you look at a general election poll amongst independents specifically, now look, basically everyone is beating Trump in that group, but nobody is beating him in the same way that Bernie Sanders is. Sanders has 10 points on him there. Oddly enough, Mike Bloomberg is doing second best there with a 6-point advantage, but it drops off from there. That is one of the things that we've been saying for years about Bernie Sanders, is that he not only is very popular amongst the Democratic primary voters, he has the highest favorability rating of anybody running amongst Democratic primary voters, but also once you go to the general election, he pulls in independents and new voters in a way that no one else does. Okay, and here's the thing, like, we could look at a million different polls, and they don't all show, as I said, the same exact story. There are general election polls that show Bernie Sanders beating Trump more than anyone else. Very recently, CNN put out one of those, so that's very important. If you go back over the last year, Joe Biden has done pretty well in those general election polls too. But what I'm saying is that if you believe that electability should be the most important concern, you cannot look at these numbers and say, well, then our decision is made for us, we should go for this candidate. You might think that Joe Biden is gonna be strong in the general election, but I'm showing you data that shows that Bernie Sanders would be at least as strong, if not stronger, among certain important groups. It becomes, at the very least, a bit of a wash, this vague concept of what is electable. Anybody can beat Donald Trump. The question is, what are they gonna do if they win? And when there's no clear winner, or at least no clear winner the mainstream media is gonna acknowledge, and Bernie Sanders is doing so well, then maybe we can go to a more substantive second tier of reasons to choose a candidate. Maybe we should look at what they've actually done, what they've actually said, what they've stood for, what they would do if they became president. Electability is important, but it looks like we're probably doing okay in terms of these general election polls. Let's actually choose a candidate that is gonna bring in new people and is gonna get stuff done if they become president. Okay, so that's what I'm thinking about as we go into the Iowa caucus. We'll see if people agree with me. We are gonna take a short break. We come back, the first two guests are gonna join us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We turn now to a pretty awful story. A student expelled from a Christian school for wearing a rainbow sweater and eating a rainbow cake. That's apparently what's going on. And joining us now to break it down, Zeke Stokes, former vice president of GLAAD and LGBTQ rights leader. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much, John. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. It's the sort of story you wish you didn't have to cover, though. So tell us about this. I know that we're gonna show some pictures that apparently were an issue for the school. But is it really as simple as like a picture of a sweater and a cake? Can you really get thrown out of a school for that?
It seems to be that simple. You know, this is a 15-year-old student who was celebrating. Her mom posted a picture of the cake with a rainbow. She was wearing a rainbow sweater, and suddenly she was being expelled from this so-called Christian school in Kentucky. You know, can you imagine, John, you know, being so hateful, so fearful, your belief system so fragile that the rainbow on a cake or a sweater would be cause for, you know, undermining the school's atmosphere. I grew up in the rural South, in rural South Carolina, going to church every time the door was open. And so you got to get up pretty early to outsmart me as it relates to the Bible. And, you know, it was actually a rainbow that God sent to Noah after the flood as a symbol that he would never destroy the earth with floods again, if you follow those beliefs. And so, you know, it's an outrageous story, but and it would be easy to sort of, I think, dismiss it as something that's, you know, a little bit of a fringe story or something out of the ordinary. But this is the kind of ideology that has a stranglehold on the right, on the Republican Party right now. And this is exactly the kind of thing they're trying to do with so-called religious freedom bills all across this country, to give people in the public space the license to discriminate based on so-called religious beliefs. We're seeing it right now in Tennessee, where there's a bill on the desk of the governor, the Republican governor there, that he has said he will sign, that allows adoption agencies to say it's against their religious beliefs to allow LGBTQ parents, otherwise loving and perfectly fit parents, to adopt. So this is a story that, you know, is a little bit silly on its face, but is really indicative of something that's very troubling going on across our country.
Yeah. Yeah, and we showed the pictures. When you look at the picture, it's like a 15-year-old girl who's smiling and she's happy. The cake looks delightful. I wish I could have some of it.
It looks delicious. And in fact, she doesn't even identify as LGBTQ herself. She just simply says she likes rainbows and colors and happy things. You know, mm-hmm. So does my 6-year-old niece. So I guess she would be subject to be expelled in this school too.
Yeah. And it's... Again, it's a symbol that has obviously been affiliated for a long time with the LGBTQ community, but it also occurs naturally in nature. Like, you can't cancel the sky. Like, having the right loves to claim that the left just gets triggered by unnecessary things, but they're freaking out over a cake and over a sweater. What they need, I think. Look, I'm not a believer or anything, but like, they need a book that preaches like tolerance and acceptance and stuff. I wish that they had a book like that. You know,
well, the
like
interesting
some historical
thing is
figure.
They do have that book. It's called the Bible.
You think
Jesus? Yeah, Jesus was a figure of acceptance and love, but somehow these folks keep dredging up things from the Old Testament that most theologians don't believe actually hold relevance today in that system of beliefs. But I want to point out, you know, something else while we're on this subject, and that is that, you know, there's a coordinated attack against LGBTQ people being led in state legislatures across this country, particularly LGBTQ youth, particularly trans youth. There are bills just filed the past week to 10 days or so, everywhere from Florida to South Dakota, a very coordinated effort to keep parents, to really intervene, to meddle in the medical decisions of parents who have transgender kids, and actually punish doctors, fine them, put them in jail for treating transgender kids medically under the recommendations of the American Association of Pediatrics. So this is something that is very real to this small group of people, but very real also in this political season that we find ourselves in, as candidates and parties are trying to find the next outrageous issue to get their base ginned up to turn out. This is, you know, they've put LGBTQ youth in particular in the crosshairs.
Yeah. There's one other aspect of the story that I like, because we were talking about, you know, like what if you had a book that could teach you how to act in this case? They seem to think that they did. So they apparently gave her a book called Gay Girl Good God, written by someone who used to be gay and then had meetings with her to discuss this book. Is this acceptable? Is this appropriate for a school? Like, and you, as you point out, she doesn't even like recognize, she doesn't identify as gay herself. So right. What is the goal there? What is the point of making a 15-year-old girl go through all this?
Well, I think what you're referencing is what would be called conversion therapy, this idea that somehow you can take someone who is LGBTQ and convert them into being something else. That's a practice that's been discredited by medical professions and psychologists and psychiatrists, and really is nothing more than child abuse by another name. But in fact, even yesterday, just yesterday in Utah, a very conservative state, you know, based in very much in the Mormon philosophy of life and religious beliefs, banned conversion therapy for that very reason. But we see it practiced in settings like this, religious schools like this, because unfortunately they can get away with it because they are a religious institution.
Yeah. And you rightly point out that like we started off saying some people might see this as sort of a fringe story or out of the norm, but there are still like we still have to fight these battles in many different states. And so it's not something that we can just like pretend has gone away or only affects a few people. It's still a very, very significant threat. Zeke Stokes, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. Lots more to get to after this. Another week, another brutal, cruel, and unnecessary crackdown on migrant rights, this time focusing on pregnant women. And as is often the case with bits of news like this, considering how little this will actually do to solve the crisis that they're saying we're experiencing, it once again seems as if the brutality, and specifically the brutality of targeting pregnant women for these sorts of changes, is the goal itself, to reassure Donald Trump's base that he continues to hate and fear this group as much as they do. So let me give you the details. Here's what they want to do. The State Department has told US embassies across the world to deny visas to people they suspect are coming to the US to give birth, according to diplomatic cables obtained by Vox. The new guidance would create barriers for pregnant people at consulates abroad applying for B visas, which are offered to short-term visitors, including tourists, business travelers, and people seeking urgent medical care. That's an important little note, don't forget that part. 2017 data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggests that the new guidance would likely affect roughly 10,000 people annually. So they start from the point of view of, if anyone comes into this country with the goal of giving birth here, thereby granting birthright citizenship to the child that is born, they must be blocked. And if that means that caught in the crosshairs will be a number of women who are simply traveling or some who need non-birth medical care that they can only get in the United States, well then, you know, omelets, eggs, you do the math. They're gonna bar thousands of people if it stops one person that they don't want being a citizen from getting citizenship. And even inside the State Department, there are people who appear to agree with that. One State Department official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said people will die because of this. And again, remember, the people who will be dying are, by the very nature of the change, pregnant women. And so again, this comes to you from the pro-life party. So this is something that is not just some minor staffer who is trying to make this change. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo himself signed off on the cable, which is drafted by a staffer who works on consular affairs. The State Department didn't immediately reply to a request for comment. Okay, they're perfectly happy for this to be publicized. They, after all, want their voters to know that we haven't forgotten. No, you hate these people. You think of citizenship as some sort of limited resource, as if some woman comes in and gives birth, that means that an American child doesn't become a citizen or something like that. And so we are continuing to attack and demonize this group. So how are they actually gonna do this in practice? Because there's a little bit of ambiguity there too. How do you know that the person is coming here to give birth? Well, according to the cable, a US consular officer can't ask a visa applicant if they're pregnant or intend to become pregnant. However, quote, If you have reason to believe the applicant will give birth during their stay in the United States, you are required to presume that giving birth for the purpose of obtaining US citizenship is the applicant's primary purpose of travel. Okay, so let's break down what they're saying there. They're saying you don't have the legal right to ask if a person is pregnant or if they're about to give birth, or if the reason they're coming in is to give birth. So you fundamentally don't even know that this person is pregnant. But if you have reason to believe, and what is that supposed to be? Like a glance at the person, a belief that they look pregnant, they look like they're about to give birth, then you are now required to assume that that isn't just a possibility, it isn't even just a certainty, but that they are pregnant and they're coming in specifically to give birthright citizenship to their child. Think about the onus that that is putting on consular workers, that they now have to observe everyone coming in and make a case-by-case evaluation of, does that person look knocked up to me? Honestly, do you think that most consular workers are trained to make that determination? And if they err on the side of blocking more and more people, again, people will die because of this, as a State Department official says. So here's the interesting thing. They, like, if you listen to right-wing media, if you listen to Sean Hannity, the radio shows and stuff like that, they're obsessed with this idea. It's one of the reasons Stephen Miller coming in was immediately dealing with birthright citizenship. They are obsessed with the idea that the rules are being broken, laws are being evaded, and just there's this flood of new people coming in and getting citizenship. They think that that's like how they're gonna lose elections going forward and all that. Let's talk about the actual numbers. There are about 4.1 million children who are US citizens and have unauthorized immigrant parents living in the US. Okay, but that does not mean 4.1 million children received birthright citizenship from people sneaking in to give birth and thus evade the rules. About 90% of non-citizen mothers with US citizen children gave birth 2 years after coming to the country or later, which means they came here, lived effectively as Americans for, in some cases, literally years, possibly met someone inside of America, got pregnant inside of America, and eventually gave birth. That isn't breaking the rules, that's living your life. And at the end of that process, what does that leave us with? More people who apparently loved America and wanted to live here for years. Giving birth to kids that, what? What are we supposed to believe about these kids is so bad that we need to twist our consular officials into knots to make sure that not a single one gets in here? They don't even make the case that, what, are these people more likely to be criminals? I know that they'll say something like that, but it's obviously not true based on the statistics we've seen. It's just assumed that anyone who looks pregnant is breaking the rules. Anyone who gets citizenship as a result of this process shouldn't have it. It's nonsense, baseless xenophobia. That's all it is. And it is, in this particular case, more transparent than always, than ever, because they are specifically targeting pregnant women who have need of medical care. Amazing and brazen, but they feel like this is what they need to do in an election year to win. Okay, that story by itself, perhaps bad enough. We got another one I wanna to let you know about what's currently happening for kids who actually make it into the country. So let's turn now to another topic. A new lawsuit is revealing absolutely horrendous, abusive behavior of migrant kids being held in a number of different facilities. Now, this report comes from Samantha Michaels of Mother Jones. It's a very long piece that talks about the experiences of a number of different migrant kids, and you should definitely take a look at it because what this lawsuit has unveiled is pretty amazing. I want to give you just a taste of what you'll see in that article, though. And it involves one kid, Antonio, not his actual name, but that's what they're referring to him here. Said Antonio hadn't broken a law, but he was detained in Virginia and it felt like a punishment. Once, when he got in a fight with an American kid who taunted him, he says staffers restrained him by tying him to a chair for 4 hours, allegedly hitting him while he sat there. This is a kid who'd broken no laws, who's being held at this facility, and then just becomes sort of a toy for the officials working there to abuse for hour after hour. Over a year and a half at the Shenandoah facility, he says he was tied to the chair about 5 times. In court documents, he recounted that staffers who restrained him would sometimes put a bag over his head meant to deter biting or spitting. He said it had small holes that I could see out of, but only a little. So remember, he's already tied to a chair for hours. Now they're putting a bag over his head. What image does that give you? The idea of a kid being treated in that way by full-grown adults. But he's not the only one. There's a boy from Honduras who described his time in the chair as almost suffocating. Quote, when you're in crisis, the bag is the least helpful thing. It's scary. He's apparently been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder before arriving there. If he hadn't already had it, it might have led to it. But a third teen recalls peeing his pants while restrained in the chair. And here's the thing, many of these kids got to America fleeing abuse, very much like what they experience in these US-based facilities in their home countries. This is physical and sexual abuse at the hands of family members. Sometimes their labor is exploited, they're forced to work at a very young age. Sometimes human trafficking, sold into sexual slavery, those sorts of things. They finally get out of there, they escape those conditions and come to America and are brutalized all over again. So this lawsuit, it was first filed in 2017 by the Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. They are going and talking to many of these teens, finding out about their stories, about the fact that many of them required mental health care when they got here. They're obviously being barred from getting that, and new traumas are being inflicted on them. I'll give you just a little bit from the actual lawsuit. So they wrote, the court's decision failed to consider that the immigrant teens are children and have not been adjudicated delinquent or convicted of any offense before they're moved to these facilities and held. The purpose of their detention is to protect them from harm, not to punish them. But they added staffers at the juvenile hall responded to the plaintiffs acting out with physical abuse and punitive imposition of restraints and solitary confinement. And even most disgustingly, when you consider that these are all kids, all of the plaintiffs that we're talking about are children, very often they are stripped as punishment, sometimes fully nude, and then left for hours to dwell, what, in shame? Their clothes aren't dangerous at this point. It's almost as if this is sexual shame being institutionalized as a punishment by full-grown adults against kids, which is sick beyond anything else perhaps in this story. So this lawsuit is continuing. Hopefully all of the kids make it out of this terrible process. Some of the kids they talked to became suicidal based on the experience they had. And again, remember, they're coming as a result of abuse that they've experienced themselves. They're not receiving mental health care, and then further abuse is being heaped on it. Is it any wonder that some of them attempt to take their own lives? It's just devastating. We should expect far more than this from our government. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, another guest is gonna be with us after this. Trump recently signed the new first phase of a trade deal with China, but what does it actually mean? What comes next, and is it the end of the trade war that we've been experiencing for a couple of years? Joining us now to break this down, Mara Vistendahl, journalist and Pulitzer Prize finalist, author of the upcoming The Scientist and the Spy, a true story of China, the FBI, and industrial espionage. Welcome to the show, very glad to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show. It's good to be here.
Great to have you. So when you heard the announcement that some sort of deal had been reached and the initial details of it began to come out, what was your response?
Well, this is really only a partial deal, really is phase one, and it's incomplete. And also the deal would not be necessary in the first place if Trump had not gotten us into the trade war. So it's a little bit like a child making a big mess in the kitchen, cleaning half of it up, and then asking for a cookie. he's made this mess, and then it's gonna be left to other people to tie up the loose ends.
So when you describe it as incomplete, what are some of the things that are missing that would make it a more substantive deal between the US and China?
Well, so in this phase one, China pledged to buy $200 billion more worth of goods, of agricultural goods and other goods from the US. But it remains to be seen whether, first of all, the US can produce that much and whether China will, in fact, buy those goods. In a way, these are promises. The deal exists so that Trump can go forth and campaign and say, look, you know, I've got a deal. He's the man of the art of the deal. And it's really just a lot of language on paper at this point. For the US, China did also make some concessions about protecting intellectual property, which has been a major goal for the trade war for the Trump administration. But those were those concessions are the direction that China was already moving in the first place. So, you know, it was already kind of heading in this direction, planning to do those things. And so therefore, it's not a lot for them to kind of sit down at the table and say, look, we'll strengthen our IP regime, we'll crack down on trade secrets theft, because they were already trying to do that at the central government level. Whether that's enforced at the local level is another question.
Definitely. And you said something there that I haven't actually heard expressed. I know that Donald Trump is very focused on the trade balance between these two countries, and he wants to get it into parity. He sees it as some sort of competition. I hadn't actually previously heard that there were concerns about whether or not our agricultural producers could actually meet the demand of the promises that have been made. Is that really up for, like, as a question? I know I was reading this article about the how much of the Iowa agricultural output ends up in China. Is there a real belief that they can't ramp up in a way that will be able to meet these new commitments?
Not specifically with agriculture, but agriculture is a major area that has been hit hard by the tariffs. And so, you know, if you look back at 2018, when Trump started this trade war and tweeted, you know, trade wars are good and easy to win, one of the first things the Chinese did in retaliation was slap tariffs on soybeans and on pork. And so farmers there have been extremely hard hit. There was a bailout that went supposedly to farmers in the Midwest. But in the end, many of those checks went to larger industrial farms, to people working with agribusiness companies, and smaller farmers got literally $5 in some cases. And so these are real people whose lives have been very hard hit, and many people are not extremely satisfied with the announcement that they're happy that there's a deal, but they're waiting until, you know, everything is signed and done.
You know, and that's really interesting, because you know, this deal comes on the back of a trade war that we've seen lots of numbers of the economic damage that it supposedly has done. He keeps saying that the tariffs are being paid by China, but we know that that's not actually how it functions. And in terms of the bailout that he did, it affects corporations, some of the producers. But in terms of this deal now, for US workers, US consumers, how much of this deal, to the extent that we have a deal so far, is actually focused around their concerns, workers and consumers, rather than corporations?
Yes, the US workers have also been hit really hard by the trade war, because you have tariffs slapped on goods that we buy from China, and average Americans, low-wage workers, tend to buy more cheap goods from China. And so those are the people who have been hard hit, in addition to farmers. Now, looking at the trade deal, there is a lot of language about protecting intellectual property, but that is language that primarily benefits corporations. So IP theft and industrial espionage from China is an issue, but it's an issue that primarily affects companies, where the victims are companies. And so for average Americans, having language about that, about those protections in the deal, is not going to make a significant difference on their lives or make up for the pain that they've been feeling as a result of the trade war.
So do we have any idea of what the timeline is for next steps, where we go from here? I know that some of the additional tariffs that were going to be put into place have been put on hold for now, but many still remain. Is there any indication that within the next 6 months or a year, there will be any change in that?
Many people don't believe that we'll see phase two before the 2020 election. So it could be left to a Democrat or whoever replaces Trump to clean up the mess that he's created. And, you know, hopefully Democrats will work in some language about climate change, about human rights in China. You have over 1 million members of the Muslim Uyghur minority interned in camps, which is a horrible issue. And so, you know, hopefully they, in addition to IP theft and these issues that benefit corporations, they'll look at some of those other issues as well.
Well, that is definitely interesting. So if based on your research, if a Democrat wins in the November election, comes in, should this be taken as an opportunity to sort of go back to the status quo of 2015, 2016 with China? I mean, what would your advice be? Would it be best to slash the tariffs unilaterally, or how exactly should a Democrat proceed?
Well, it's very complicated, and the picture doesn't involve just tariffs, but also Chinese investment in the United States, and that's something that could create jobs for Americans. You know, when you look, the two countries have been on a collision course for the past few years. You have these narcissistic, nationalistic leaders in charge in both countries, so both Trump and Xi Jinping, and they have been ratcheting up tensions. But when it comes to our economies, we are incredibly interlinked. So not just the goods that we buy from China and the goods that they buy from us, but you know, looking at a place like Iowa, the relationship with China goes back to the 1980s when you started to see these connections forged. And Xi Jinping made a trip to Iowa and befriended the governor at the time. He actually stayed with the local family. And before the trade war was started, Iowa was hugely dependent on business from China.
Interesting. Well, Mara, we really appreciate you joining us and breaking this down. I know that your book is coming out in just like a week and a half, and we're going to have you back on to talk about the book then. So look forward to speaking to you in the very near future, and thank you for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, news from around the world. And meanwhile, in. And now it's news from around the world, and meanwhile in. Meanwhile in China, the situation there with the coronavirus continues to pose a big problem, both for the people and for the government. You might have seen a lot of headlines recently like this: China quarantines 20 million people in three cities, and a vaccine could be 3 months away. Although honestly, with the way that information is clamped down on and the inherent dishonesty that the Chinese government has shown on this topic, when they say 3 months, what does that actually mean? Do we actually know? And so it is scary. At least 17 deaths have already been confirmed. More than 630 people have been infected. So it's serious. It's not to the extent of something like SARS or bird flu or the swine flu or anything like that. But those sorts of things they create a sort of precedent in the mind. We're worried about it spreading in that way, especially because cases of the virus have been detected in other parts of China, Hong Kong, Macau, and other countries, including Japan, South Korea, the United States, and Thailand. Singapore and Vietnam are the latest to join the list. So you have this quarantine now, you have it being taken seriously, but it has already spread to multiple countries and without an easy fix anywhere in sight. To give you an idea of what it actually does, the infected develop upper respiratory symptoms, including a runny nose, cough, sore throat, and sometimes a fever that can last a few days. But for those with weakened immune systems, the elderly and the very young, the virus may trigger more serious illnesses like pneumonia and bronchitis. And so in this way, a lot of the symptoms, the progression is similar to some of the other diseases we've seen cropping up in China over the past few years. So there's a lot of concern inside of China about whether the government can be trusted in this area. For weeks, the government had mostly treated the outbreak as a problem isolated to the city of Wuhan. It was only after the Hong Kong news media reported that cases of the coronavirus had been detected elsewhere that the government finally began to acknowledge that this was not a thing limited to one tiny geographic area. It was a more significant issue. And so now when they say, well, we've almost got this vaccine, a lot of people are predisposed not to necessarily believe that. For people inside of the United States, US-bound travelers from Wuhan are being routed to 5 airports for screening in Chicago, New York, Atlanta, LA, and San Francisco. And remember that is being met with a quarantine in China. But again, it is a serious concern. It's in multiple different countries within the region. We will have to see if all of the governments and their screening processes for international travelers are up to the task. Meanwhile, Lynn. Meanwhile, in the oceans, things are really heating up in a really weird, terrible way. It's really dark, okay? I wanna give you some numbers of how much heat has been added to the ocean that are gonna blow your mind. So there's a new study, it was published this Monday, shows that the Earth's oceans reached the highest temperatures and warmed the fastest since records began. Now, to put it in perspective, the report says the amount of heat we've put in the world's oceans in the past 25 years equals 3.6 billion Hiroshima atom bomb explosions. This measured ocean warming is irrefutable and is further proof of global warming. There are no reasonable alternatives aside from the human emissions of heat trapping gases to explain this heating. So 3.6 billion atom bomb explosions. We are now at 5 to 6 bombs of heat each second. So it's as if we were igniting that many atom bombs every single second of every single day, and the ocean is heating up more and more and more. So what effect does that have? Well, it says the price we pay is the reduction of ocean dissolved oxygen, the harm marine lives, strengthening storms, and reduced fisheries and ocean related economies. However, the more we reduce greenhouse gases, the less the ocean will warm. So this is super important. And thankfully, in the past couple of years, people have started to focus more on the effect of the ocean in climate change, but also the effect that climate change has on the ocean. The ocean is heating up disproportionately more than the air, but the ocean has a limit. It can only heat up so much. Along the way, tons of damage will be done. And for the huge number of people, literally billions every day, whose protein intake is dependent on the products of the ocean, that's significant. But at some point, the ocean will be tapped out. Will no longer be allowed or no longer be able to absorb some of the excess heating that we're generating. And that's when you have an acceleration in the air. And so things have been proceeding, but again, we always say it is not a linear process and it is not a constant process. There are going to be tipping points. The ocean is a big one, and it can only sustain so many atom bombs worth of heat being added on a daily basis. There's also been some really bad news recently of more and more ocean life, including whales, washing on shore with their bodies filled with plastic. So aside from the heat, we're putting a lot of other terrible things in the ocean. We need to think about that too. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into detail. So I will just say, meanwhile in. Meanwhile, around the world, the strength of the US stock market is not necessarily being mirrored in the experiences of billions of people. Some people are doing very well, some not so much. Let's talk about both groups. So there's nearly 500 million people around the world struggling to find adequate paid work, trapping individuals in a poverty and fueling heightened levels of inequality. This is according to a new UN report. 500 million people that might be able to find some work, but not enough to necessarily sustain their lives, let alone prosper. Out of a working age population of 5.7 billion people around the world, this report found that as many as 165 million people were employed but unable to find work with an adequate amount of paid hours to meet their needs. It also found a further 119 million had either given up actively searching for work or lacked access to the job markets because of their personal situations. Alongside those officially classified as unemployed, there's about 473 million people across the planet being affected in a similar way. These are huge numbers, a lot of them outside of the United States, but they're out there and they are struggling at the same time that some people are doing quite well. A new report found that the world's 2,153 billionaires have more wealth than 4.6 billion people. And that number is interesting, not just who they have more wealth than, but the absolute number of billionaires, that has been changing a lot too. This new report shows that the number of billionaires has doubled in the past decade. So that puts us right back to around the initial recovery from the Great Recession. A lot had been done, you know, these banks had been shored up inside of the United States and many other countries. And then largely things went back to normal in terms of the political status quo. But the recovery was never equitable. It never affected all groups evenly. Many people's wages have not gotten back up to where they need to be. They're not keeping pace with inflation. Many people's savings were absolutely wiped out. But at the same time, billionaires have not only recovered, they've in fact doubled in time since then. To put it in a world perspective, the 22 richest men in the world have more money than all of the women in Africa. That entire region of the world, you can take a tiny handful of men, they could fit comfortably in this room for some sort of cocktail gathering, and more money than all the women in Africa. So we are seeing huge gains for a very small number of people, literally just a couple of thousand people, and billions and billions of people struggling, increasingly so. Many unable to find any work, hundreds and hundreds of millions more able to find some work, but not enough to live an actual life of dignity and freedom. And I have a great quote from Oxfam India CEO Amitar Betar, who says, "The gap between rich and poor can't be resolved without deliberate inequality busting policies. And too few governments are committed to these. Our broken economies are lining the pockets of billionaires and big business at the expense of ordinary men and women. No wonder people are starting to question whether billionaires should even exist." And that's at a time when they're becoming increasingly common. Some people are benefiting, but until the government stops just taking their marching orders from these people, organizing things in a way that more and more of that money is gonna flow to the very top, we are not gonna fix this inequality. The system is not designed to do so. So the system itself needs to be changed. That's the only solution. Okay, thank you so much for joining me for this packed episode of The Damage Report. We've got more to close out the week tomorrow with Brett Ehrlich, host of The Happy Half Hour. We will see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.